And when the American team came to China, they played ping pong with the Chinese. This was covered by live television, which was very rare in China in the early 1970s, and also widely by a live radio broadcast. And in the competition, interestingly, you find the Chinese presented it in such a way. You know, the Americans were always beaten in team match, but it's not in the team match. It's a 9 games. It's never 9-0. It's like always 6-3, 5-4. So the Americans were given face, but in the same time, every Chinese knew, watching the game, listening to the report of the game, they know China was in control.
As Cheng Jian writes, in a few short days, ping pong diplomacy had completely changed the political atmosphere between the US and China. On the 29th of May, 1971, Chinese Prime Minister Zhou Enlai sent a message to Washington saying that Mao was looking forward to direct conversations with Nixon and inviting Kissinger to come to Beijing for a top-secret meeting to prepare the ground. When Nixon saw the message, he declared, "This is the most important communication that has come to an American president since World War II." Preparations began for Kissinger's visit. He would fly first to Pakistan and then on to Beijing on a Pakistani plane. Secrecy was paramount. But as Kissinger was getting ready to board his flight, another foreign visitor was stepping onto a train in Kowloon, also bound for Beijing. And that visitor was Australian opposition leader Gough Whitlam. Travelling with Whitlam was a delegation of Labor Party MPs, advisers, and a bevy of journalists, including a camera crew from the ABC.
Being suggested that you're making some political capital out of this and creating an embarrassment to the Australian government. What do you say to that?
No, I'm not. There's nothing, of course, that we've said or done that should embarrass the Australian government at all. Certain it is that we believe in the Labor Party that this initiative, which we took, will suit the Labor Party's interests. But also, it's certain to suit Australia's interests.
Also travelling with the delegation was a young academic, Stephen Fitzgerald, who'd go on to become Australia's first ambassador to China.
How bold a step was it for Gough Whitlam to go to China with the delegation that you were on?
In the political climate in Australia at the time and in our relations with the United States, it was extremely bold, and there was a lot of hesitation about it, and there were a lot of people in the Labor Party who opposed it because they thought it was too risky at that stage with the election coming up the following year, where it looked for the first time since 1949 that Labor might get back. The whole question of communism had been the big divisive issue in our foreign policy since the 1950s. And of course, central to all of that was China and the idea that China was thrusting down through Southeast Asia towards Australia.
At the time Gough Whitlam went to China, Australia, like the United States, didn't recognise the communist government, and we opposed China's admission to the United Nations. But behind the scenes in Canberra, officials were arguing that it was time for a change.
By the end of the 1960s, many new developing countries are starting to become members of the United Nations, and these countries are generally much more sympathetic to the People's Republic of China than the Western countries. And even among Western countries, some of these are breaking ranks with the United States to recognise China. France did in 1964, and Italy and Canada in 1970. So by about 1970, it's becoming clear that fairly sooner or later, the majority of the UN General Assembly are going to vote to seat the People's Republic of China as the government of China in the United Nations. And there would be a worry in the Department of Foreign Affairs that Australia might be left lagging behind a trend, an international trend, in favour of accommodating China in the international community.
Dr. David Lee. He's Director of the Historical Publications and Information Section of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, or DFAT. In 2002, DFAT published a collection of previously classified documents on the lead-up to Australia's recognition of China. The documents tell a revealing story. More than a year before Whitlam went to China, senior officials and diplomats were advising the then Liberal Country Party government that there was, quote, an urgent need to review our policy towards China. But the government was cautious. It didn't want to break ranks with our closest ally. Stuart Doran.
The Australians knew there was a movement in US policy. As far back as February 1970, the Australian ambassador in Washington, then Keith Waller, he had warned back then that there was little doubt that the tide is running strongly in favour of a new look in United States-China policy, including a readiness to take initiatives. But the problem was that no one in Canberra knew exactly what moves the Americans contemplated. This meant that there was an unwillingness in Cabinet to do anything bold. In essence, they were caught on the horns of a dilemma to try to not fall behind internationally and to not offend the PRC on the one hand, and then on the other, they were concerned that the Americans might object to early moves on recognition or anything that was perceived as being radical.
Mr. Whitlam and his party have been told they can raise any subject. It would appear that Australia will learn a great deal from these talks, and already some of the political facts of
Whitlam would say that he had been calling for the recognition of China from the time he entered the parliament, and I think in one of his earliest statements in the parliament, he did just that. So he had long had a position that Australia should have diplomatic relations with China. He also was reading the signs of what might be coming up in the global attitude towards China.
But while the talks go on, we have time to see the seat of Chairman Mao Zedong's all-embracing power. This is the centre of Peking, Tiananmen Square, with the rostrum where Chairman Mao takes the salute before millions. The vast square and the Great Hall of the People are the pride of Peking. Soldiers queue here to have their photographs taken by professional photographers.
The highlight of the Whitlam visit was a meeting with Chinese Prime Minister Zhou Enlai.
We go into the Great Hall and he comes forward to meet you, and you then go and sit in a kind of horseshoe-shaped array of chairs, and it's a one-to-one conversation between the two leaders on both sides, Zhou Enlai to Whitlam. The Chinese cameras always come in at the beginning, and you have their television and their still photographers, and that all goes through some initial chat session.
The summons to us came toward midnight. He worked all night, and we'd been told there was a film that night. And then when they said, put on a jacket and tie, I realised it wasn't a film, but I didn't say anything.
Ross Terrell. He was one of the Australian journalists who was present at Whitlam's meeting with Zhou. Zhou Enlai questioned Whitlam about the ANZUS alliance and about his attitude to the war in Vietnam. What you're about to hear now is a historic recording of part of that conversation, captured by ABC soundman Willie Fuhr.
I heard that your party advocates the complete withdrawal of all the U.S. forces of aggression were sent to Vietnam by the Australian government.
Yes.
Is that so?
That is so.
自从澳大利亚政府在1965年第一次派兵进入南越的时候，我们就提出这个要求，要求澳大利亚政府。
是啊，这应该要各国人民解决自己的问题。
Because the people
不允许外人干涉。
the peoples of various countries should be allowed to solve their own problems by themselves, and foreign interference should not be permitted.
Zhou was also curious to know if Whitlam had met Henry Kissinger. Whitlam hadn't, and he didn't know at the time why Zhou was so curious.
There's no need for a very long discussion, so long as we are in concurrence on the major problem that's good.
At the end of the meeting, Zhou says to Whitlam, "You're very young," to which Whitlam replies, "You're still as strong as ever."
You're very young.
What? Why?
You're as strong as ever.
中年那个身体还是跟过去一样强。 Getting old.
Thank you very much, Your Excellency. It's been a very great honour.
Zhou Enlai was simply impressive. I mean, it's not a value judgment, I don't think. At the end, he said to Whitlam very bluntly, "What you've said tonight is just words. Now you've got to go back and be elected and turn it into deeds." It was almost like an instruction.
Whitlam would go on to recognise China as one of his first acts as Prime Minister. But at the time, his visit to Beijing drew sharp criticism in Australia.
Well, the Prime Minister at the time, William McMahon, was extremely annoyed about the Whitlam visit, and he publicly stated that the Chinese Premier, Chou Enlai, had played Whitlam as a fisherman plays a trout. And he also said that Labor's policy would result in Australia becoming a pawn of the giant communist power of our region. But this was very quickly undercut when shortly afterwards Australia learned that Nixon's national security advisor Henry Kissinger had made a visit to Peking himself.
"The announcement I shall now read is being issued simultaneously in Peking and in the United States. Premier Chou Enlai and Dr. Henry Kissinger, President Nixon's Assistant for National Security Affairs, held talks in Peking from July 9 to 11, 1971.
When Kissinger visit was announced, McMahon was absolutely apoplectic. The cornerstone of Australian policy had been to wait on the US, and now the US had very publicly shown that it would do what it liked, regardless of Australia's loyalty or the loyalty of other allies. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that relations between Australian conservative governments and US administrations reached an all-time low, certainly a post-war low at this point.
There was too much riding on Kissinger's talks with Zhou Enlai to risk any premature leaks. Only three trusted officials travelled with him, and one of them was William Smizer. Here's how Smizer describes the atmosphere of the talks.
"Oh yes, they were very frank, they were brutally frank, but they were frank in a way in which you know that people want to express their sense of what is going on, they want to express their sense of the problems that exist, but they also want to leave room for openings for a solution. And it was that sense that we had very quickly in these conversations. In fact, I remember when we retired to our delegation quarters, which were in one of the guest houses, we all remarked, we've got a problem, we've got a lot of things to do while we're here, but it looks doable."
The Americans knew that the major sticking point to a new relationship with China would be Taiwan. Nixon had told Kissinger that the US had to be cold about its ties with Taiwan because its ties with China were of greater strategic importance. Now, in Kissinger's memoirs, which were published in the late 1970s, he claimed that Taiwan had only been discussed in passing at those secret talks. But the transcript of the talks, which was declassified a few years ago, tells a different story. It shows that Kissinger and Zhou talked at length about Taiwan, and that Kissinger made major concessions to the Chinese. Zhou stated the Chinese position bluntly at the outset.
We hold that our relations with Taiwan is a question of China's internal affairs. If relations are to be established between our two countries, China and the United States, the United States must recognize that the PRC is the sole legitimate government in China, and that Taiwan province is an inalienable part of Chinese territory which must be restored to the motherland.
And Kissinger's reply was no less frank.
As for the political future of Taiwan, we are not advocating a two China's solution or a one China, one Taiwan solution. As a student of history, one's prediction would have to be that the political evolution is likely to be in the direction which Prime Minister Zhou Enlai indicated to me.
These were the words the Chinese wanted to hear. William Burr from the National Security Archive in Washington.
That in his talks with Zhou Enlai, Kissinger used, really he had to use language that was in the direction of the Chinese stance, that there was only one China and that Taiwan was part of China. To do that, Kissinger repudiated, this is right from the documents, Kissinger repudiated the older idea that there were two Chinas. He told Zhou Enlai that we were not advocating a two Chinas solution or a one China, one Taiwan solution. Now, Kissinger, however, was very careful not to accept the Chinese language that Taiwan was part of China. He never said that. He drew back by making that concession. But what he said was enough for Zhou Enlai.
So, in other words, Kissinger was prepared in these secret talks to make a very substantial movement in the direction of the position that China wanted on Taiwan in order to, if you like, pave the way for closer relations, but also to pave the way for the subsequent visit by President Nixon.
Absolutely. After Kissinger made the statement about repudiating a two Chinas policy, Zhou Enlai said,
"With respect to what you have just said now, that is, your opinions on historical evolution and that you do not advocate a two Chinas or one China, one Taiwan solution, which you just now clearly expressed, this shows that the prospect for a solution and the establishment of diplomatic relations between our two countries is hopeful."
The prospect for a solution and the establishment of diplomatic relations between our two countries is hopeful. This made it evident that what Kissinger had said was a deal maker. If he had been less forthcoming on Taiwan, the talks might have gone nowhere.
Kissinger had pushed aside the greatest obstacle on the road to rapprochement with China. But the US still had a pressing concern of its own, the war in Vietnam.
The US should be held mainly responsible for the enlargement of the war in Indochina, and there is no way to shirk that responsibility.
That is history. And our problem now is how to end it.
We wanted the Chinese to lift their objections to a negotiated settlement. The Chinese, from the moment that American troops had entered Vietnam, had said there can be no negotiations with the enemy who is occupying your territory. They had been vehement on this point, and they had always said the North Vietnamese, or the Vietnamese people, as they said them, must fight on and must fight on until victory. There can be no negotiated solution. We wanted to end that. And so one of the things that Kissinger did, and with my encouragement, was to pursue the line with them that a negotiated settlement would end the war.
China had been a close ally of North Vietnam's throughout the war. Kissinger was hoping now that China would use its influence with the North Vietnamese regime to make them more receptive to a peace settlement. Kissinger signalled clearly to Zhou Enlai that he and Nixon wanted to get the US out of Vietnam, whatever it took.
I would like to tell the Prime Minister, on behalf of President Nixon, as solemnly as I can, that, first of all, we are prepared to withdraw completely from Indochina and to give a fixed date if there is a ceasefire and release of our prisoners. Secondly, we will permit the political solution of South Vietnam to evolve and to leave it to the Vietnamese alone.
What about the forces of the other countries which followed the U.S.?
They would withdraw also.
On this point, I must state that the Vietnamese people are not short-sighted. It is precisely they who have made a great contribution to world peace. You must know that your newspapers and your people and even some of your demobilized army men and active army men all declared and expressed your cruelties in Vietnam.
But you have to understand two things. This is the tragedy of war. Our position is not to maintain any particular government in South Vietnam. What we cannot do is to participate in the overthrow of people with whom we have been allied, whatever the origin of that alliance. If the government is as unpopular as you seem to think, then the quicker our forces are withdrawn, the quicker it will be overthrown. And if it is overthrown, after we withdraw, we will not intervene.
I think by saying things like that, and he keeps saying things like that when in more talks with Zhou Enlai, Kissinger no doubt hoped that China would pass on the message to the Vietnamese, who in turn would then be more accommodating when they spoke with Kissinger in Paris about the peace settlement. So I think he hoped that they would help indirectly by telling the Vietnamese what Kissinger is saying about the post-war situation.
I think in this respect he was not successful at all. It's very interesting if you read through the transcripts of those meetings in July 1971, Zhou Enlai is not indicating at any point that China would be willing to exert even the slightest pressure on Vietnam. But the major goal of this visit in 71, of course, was to secure an invitation of Nixon to Beijing. I mean, this was the major thing which he wanted to achieve. And for that, he went very far with regard to Taiwan, Vietnam, and Korea, to water down and sometimes even abandon our publicly held American positions just to, because this was actually what Nixon expected from him, to come back and have an invitation in his hand.
Bernd Schaefer, author of the forthcoming book Tigers in the Valley, East Asian Communism and American-Soviet Rivalry. Richard Nixon got the invitation he wanted. On May 22, 1972, Nixon stepped down from Air Force One onto the tarmac in Beijing. What followed was a truly operatic spectacle, geopolitical passion on a global stage.
The world watches, the world listens, the world waits.
It was as if the Americans had just decided this was the moment. They were now going to get back with China. After all, in the Great Hall of the People at the dinner, Nixon in his toast quoted Mao's poetry as if it was holy scripture. And this is a man who in the 1950s talked of Mao as a totalitarian dictator, which of course he was, but that all went out the window.
Mr. Nixon quoted Mao Zedong, "Seize the day, seize the hour," said the president. "Let us start a long march together."
I ask all of you present to join me in raising your glasses. Chairman Mao, Prime Minister Zhou, and to the friendship of the Chinese and American people, which can lead to friendship and peace for all people in the world.
The Chinese-American rapprochement was an international PR triumph for Mao and Nixon, but it didn't achieve everything that they'd hoped for. Rather than helping to bring a speedier end to the Vietnam War, it almost certainly prolonged it.
the North Vietnamese leadership reacted angrily. They accused Mao of throwing a life buoy to Nixon, who had almost been drowned. And an already paranoid Soviet leadership saw itself increasingly being frozen out of influence in East Asia. Even before Nixon went to Beijing, Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev told a meeting of Eastern European communist leaders that the Soviet Union would now increase its support to North Vietnam.
And he said, quote, following a request of the Vietnamese comrades, we have decided to send a high-ranking party and state delegation to Vietnam. With all that, we are going to counter Nixon and Mao. While Nixon visits Beijing without ending American aggression in Indochina, the Soviet Union will be present in Vietnam at the highest level and sign important agreements, including further military aid. And I think this is really telling. The U.S. signed a rapprochement, at least in late 71 and then 72, was actually fueling the conflict in Vietnam because now the Soviet Union saw a chance to outflank China in Vietnam.
You could say that China emerged as the real winner from this crucial turning point in Cold War history. Mao's meeting with Nixon would pave the way for China's transformation over the next three decades, its integration into the global economy and emergence as a rising superpower.
Since the Mao-Nixon handshake, there was no further US entry into any new conflict in East Asia, nor has there been in three or four decades since. Instead of the domino theory, where the Southeast Asia would become communist because of Hanoi's victory in Vietnam, it was a victory for an age of capitalist economic development. None of that would have been possible but for the live and let live deal that was essentially done by the Americans and Beijing, and in a different way by Australia and by Japan and others.
The Cold War ended with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc. What we saw from the Chinese-American rapprochement was that now the Soviet Union, in order to deal with the United States, while at the same time facing challenges from China, really became overextended in its power. So in this sense, I believe, indeed, the Chinese-American rapprochement played a crucial role in leading to the end of the Cold War with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Soviet-led communist bloc.
You've been listening to Hindsight on ABC Radio National, and the fourth episode of our special series, Torn Curtain, The Secret History of the Cold War. Technical production today was by Judy Rapley, Henry Kissinger was played by William Zappa, and Joanne Lai by Darren Yap.